There's an amazing Chinese saying, 初生牛犊不怕虎, which means the newborn cub does not fear the tiger.
Could you take us on the journey of how you got
the thing that I learned about being a producer?
Kind of, whatever it's taken to get to this point.
A completely different perspective.
That's my job.
Using Heroes, a Circa podcast.
Hi, it's Yaron. Thanks for joining us to meet today's producing hero, Alison Friedman. Alison is currently Artistic Director of Performing Arts at West Kowloon Cultural District Authority. It's a huge role at a massive place. So Alison, welcome. Could you take us on the journey of how you got here?
Thank you, Yaron. I've been in Hong Kong for 3 years now, and the journey that brought me here was definitely a producer's journey, and it's what producing is to me has always been about connections, cross-cultural connections. Before living in Hong Kong for 3 years, I was in Beijing for almost 16 years. And the last eight of those was running a company I started called Ping Pong Productions, whose mission was bringing China and the world together through the performing arts. So it was about using the arts as a bridge to connect this massive country that was becoming a huge player on the world stage, but was very misunderstood, not understood well enough. And as those of us who work in this industry understand, the arts have this power to show, don't tell. You know, a newspaper article is going to tell you what to think. A government report will tell you what to think. A commercial advertisement on television will tell you what to buy. But that doesn't hit you at the emotional level, which will show you something and create empathy. So that was my reason for starting Ping Pong. And then that was my reason for coming here to Hong Kong and to join the incredible team at West Kowloon Cultural District, because this is one of the largest platforms for performing arts and culture museums in the world. We're building many performing arts centers, two museums, huge outdoor open space. And so here was an opportunity to take my producing dreams to this platform in the middle of Asia, which is, I believe it when they say the 21st century is Asia's century. And here we are to use our producing superhero powers to bring about world peace, frankly. Is that too big an option? Too big a dream?
And listen, for you, I don't think anything's too big a dream.
What makes somebody want to cause other people to be successful?
For me, it's about falling in love. What I've found is the artists that I've been able to work with and help create their careers are, honestly, I have to fall in love with them, their passion, their vision first. And ultimately, this is a people industry that we're in. We care about people. That's why we do this. We care about our audiences. Even if we don't know them, there has to be an element of love for these audiences, for these communities, for the places that we want to bring this art. And because we love them and because we love the artists, we want to bring that love together and make the world. I mean, it sounds so hokey when it comes out of my mouth, but it is truly about making the world a better place.
Now, look, there's definitely a place for the inevitable hallmark moment in every conversation. In every conversation, I love that you love superheroes. And one of my personal favorites is Jessica Jones, and she's got this quote where she says, "My greatest weakness, occasionally I give a damn." And is that a weakness that Alison Friedman suffers? And if so, is it
damn
a weakness?
It. I think like every superhero or every mythic god or creature, your greatest strength can be your greatest weakness. And I think giving a damn is both why producers are so good and why we just drive ourselves crazy. I think that actually somebody said something to me about that I've always kept in mind when I am advocating for artists as a producer. And it's even though I hate sports metaphors, it was a metaphor about the Olympics. So back to Olympian superheroes. The difference between a silver and a gold sometimes comes down to 0.02 seconds. And that's why when I was doing a load-in on tour with Tao Dance Theater, when I was working with artists and they'd get demanding about the white Marley isn't white enough, or that light needs to be re-rigged to move it 2 centimeters, And people around you think that is why do you care? Why do you give a damn about those 2 centimeters? And I think it is that difference between a silver and a gold. It can come down to those, the devils in the details, to those minor differences. And, you know, the artists can't always do it by themselves. We're the catalyst. We're the catalytic force that helps bring those dreams to reality.
Absolutely. I work with a sports psychologist who has trained Olympians, and she says that everybody gives up training sport because at some point it hurts too much. And the last person who gives up wins the gold medal.
Wow.
Have you, which I love it for its absolute brutality and uncompromisingness. Have you come to those points where you've given up? Has it hurt too much?
I think the short answer is yes. I think but I don't know if it's a give up. I think it's a pivot. I have to be honest. One of the reasons I came to West Kowloon wasn't just because the draw of this incredibly ambitious dream of a project. Frankly, I was tired of running my own company, and the producing and the working with artists and the delivering inspiring, emotionally impactful, transcendent experiences to audiences, I still believed in. I didn't give up on the pain of that, but the pain of running a business and having to earn your own salary and deal with all of the administrative things that being an entrepreneur is, that I hit a wall. And so the idea of working for someone else, so many people say, I'm so tired of working for someone else. I want to work for myself. I had the exact opposite experience. After 8 years of running my own company, I said, for the love of God, I want someone else to be the boss and I want it to be their problem. And I want to focus on the art.
I think one of the things that makes me think about is when I look at the statistics that you spoke about at the beginning of the conversation, you said you were in Beijing for 16 years, it was 3 years. And for people who don't have the ability to see Alison, she's not terribly long in the tooth, as we say,
shucks.
which means that there was a fairly young person, a foreigner in a strange, presumably fairly strange culture, who decided to go and do something by themselves. In effect, they produced themselves. And that must have taken an extraordinary amount of courage, perhaps foolhardiness, but I'd love to know what that's about.
There's an amazing Chinese saying, 出生牛犊不怕虎, which means the newborn cub does not fear the tiger. And it's a little bit of that you're too young and naive to know to be afraid. And I think about that phrase often when I think back to being 20 years old, 22 years old, and venturing off to China and getting a Fulbright to go research performance in China. I think there's an element of beginner's mind that I often now try and bring back, because I think as producers, we are in the industry of solving problems and making shit happen. And to do that, you have to not be afraid. You have to think you're not going to come up against the wall. You're just going to come over the next hurdle and you're just going to have to jump higher or go under or go around. And so I think what was so exciting to be 20 years old, 22 years old and going to China was the energy in that country. It was the lead up to the Olympics. I went around, my first time was in 2000, then again, 2001. Then the Fulbright was in 2002 and the Olympics was around the corner in 2008. And there was this palpable creative entrepreneurial energy in a city like Beijing that felt like, my friend called it adolescent energy, which I quite liked. It was brazen, it was confident, it was sexy. It was this opening up to the world after such a long time of not necessarily being asleep, but being in a different phase. And what was so inspiring was meeting the artists and the arts organizations that I worked with at that time, Beijing Modern Dance Company, Tao Dance Theater, which I helped build, the director Wang Chong, who I got to know a little bit later. It was this feeling that together we are running towards the same goal. We're building something new. We get to create something that didn't exist before. I started working at Beijing Modern Dance Company soon after my Fulbright ended. And I remember thinking, okay, I could go back to New York City or LA or Chicago or somewhere in Europe and work for any number of modern dance companies. No, you know, no problem. Why am I doing this here in Beijing? And it was precisely that. It was because there aren't 10,000 modern dance companies in a city like Beijing. There were maybe 2. and maybe five in the whole country at that time. So that potential to create, that potential to have a group of like-minded, insane individuals who believed in this this dream and were together working to make it a reality was the most intoxicating thing to be a part of. And it's what kept me there, that energy of creation and opportunity and like-minded individuals with a shared mission and goal was what kept me there so long.
You've been working as on the selling side, I mean, in terms of from the company side, and now you're working for the buyer, which means my experience of going from running Circa, which I still do, to running the Commonwealth Games Arts Festival was suddenly I was really popular and everybody wanted to be my friend. And it took me a while. It took me a while to realize that I'd rocked up to the party with a big budget and an opportunity that everybody, including myself, by that wanted. How have you navigated that? And what are the different kind of producing challenges and ways of thinking about things from the buyer to the seller?
I remember one of the first conferences I went to after coming to West Kowloon, and it was confusing because at Ping Pong Productions, when you're running your own independent management producing company, you're on the hustle. And you have every minute stacked. I had my roster of artists and the different projects I wanted to do and the targets in my crosshairs to meet with about that. And to then show up at the same conference a year later on the West Kowloon side, on the presenter venue side, I realized I don't have to run around. It was confusing. I didn't know what to do with all this time I suddenly had. And it was such a luxury to say, oh, they're going to come to me, or who do I, you know, actually, what are the artists I want to meet with? So I'm not going to lie. It was a bit of an adjustment psychologically. I think one thing before I arrived at West Kowloon, what they did very well is they set up the performing arts division and the programming team in the mindset of producers. And a lot of the people came from a background of independent producing, either mostly in Hong Kong. My division is almost exclusively, I think I'm the only foreigner here now, and then one other person from Singapore. And I think that's so important for a venue to be populated with people who know what it's like being on the other side, being on the artist side, being on the selling side, being on the scrappy artist side, because it ensures that we don't kind of lose touch, frankly, and understand in our venues just how important it is when an artist says that white isn't white enough, that we don't get grumpy and annoyed, but we say, of course, we've been there, we've been that artist, we've been representing that artist. And it creates a different set of mindset and goggles. I have to say, this past January, we had Wayne McGregor performing Autobiography at our new venue, Free Space, which is our new Center for Contemporary Performance. It's a big black box theater that opened in June of 2019. So it hadn't even been 6 months of being open. And when he left, he said to me, Allison, this was one of the best places in terms of technicians and technical capacity of the people we've ever worked with. And that's a company that's toured everywhere on the planet. So that's high praise to have a company that's been everywhere, worked with everybody, say this is one of the best technical teams we've ever worked with. And it's because a lot of the technicians in our venues come from Hong Kong Ballet, come from, you know, festival scenarios. And so they understand the artist mindset. They're not, you know, you're in my house, why are you disturbing me?
How do you bring your team along on that journey?
I think one of the biggest differences between working in smaller organizations that are more, I don't want to say more entrepreneurial, but I guess just smaller versus large institutions, is larger institutions get much more, have a tendency to get more siloed. You might have the one person where all they do are the visa forms, and then marketing sits over in that side of the building or in maybe an entirely separate building, and then programmers are over here. And so, whereas with Ping Pong Productions, I was used to kind of doing everything from start to finish myself. And then eventually when I was able to afford staff, you know, we would all share duties and there was no hierarchy and it was just a matter of the program. With West Kowloon and now coming in as artistic director, a lot of what I feel the role is stitching things together and creating the connective tissue so other people will actually do it. I don't go do those things like I used to do when I was independent or when I was running my own company. I have to create frameworks so that other people are freed up to do what they do and talk to each other. And it's an ongoing process. I would by no means ever claim that here's how you do it. I'm still learning. 3 years in feels both like 30 years and 30 minutes. But I think the one thing I have learned that needs to happen and that I'm trying to hone my skills is that connective tissue. Yes, my team of experts, I have a head of theater, head of dance, head of music, head of Chinese opera. They have incredible expertise and different companies and artists they want to work with. My job is to help create the structure and the strategy to help us make the decision why this dance company, not that one. So they maybe get to go choose that, but I'm the connective tissue and the skeleton structure to help create the framework so they know what are the parameters under which they're working. And that also involves the financial piece. As a venue, we are dealing with the financial viability of a huge building that has something like a visionary architecture who built a building that is a terrible business structure with open doors in a humid city that has typhoons and the cleaning bills. I mean, these are things I never used to have to think about. Now I'm thinking about cleaning bills because it impacts the overall operations of that building. So the producing element is shifting from, you know, things as an independent producer, you never thought you'd have to, how many times you'd have to take someone to an emergency room, that was going to be in your job description, to now I never thought that thinking about air conditioner ducts was going to be part of being an artistic director.
What do you do when an artist you greatly love or a company that you're deeply engaged with brings you an idea that stinks? And I'm responsible for several, so I can say that I know it happens. I have that relationship with a number of presenters, and sometimes I bring them an idea and it's just
a bad idea. Yeah. I guess two things. I think that ongoing, whether it's an independent producer or now in role as artistic director, our jobs have to be about trust, because the safest space is the space where you can have a lot of really bad ideas, and you're not worried about having them, and you know that you're not in danger if you have nine bad ones, because you're lucky if you have one good one, and the only way to get to that one good one is to have the nine bad ones. So I kind of hope that at West Kowloon we can, you know, among my team, we're fostering a space where we can all have bad ideas and talk about them and then get to the good one. It's less awkward and uncomfortable, I guess, the more trust you have. And one of the things I had to do when I first came into West Kowloon, you know, the newbie, they always get you. And I felt like I was given a lot of things that were bad ideas that got too far, and I had to come in and do a little bit of house cleaning. So there was one partnership that was supposed to be a 3-year thing, and after year one it just wasn't going anywhere and it was a money drain, and so I was tasked as the new one to go in and kind of call scene on that one. And yeah, it's awkward. I don't know, sometimes if the artist or our colleagues, our producers here in the institution have enough ideas, you can do the yeah, okay, great, next, okay, what else, okay, yeah, okay, interesting, let's think about it, what else, and kind of move past them on the conveyor belts.
On the converse side, on good ideas, obviously your tour of Disgraced was a good idea, but not on paper necessarily. Mm-hmm. So how did you figure out that it was a good idea, and what did you do to make sure that it worked as well as it did?
So Disgraced, Ayad Akhtar's play, one of the last tours I did at Ping Pong before I came to West Kowloon. And that project was a good idea that my producer, Meng Tong Guan, who eventually took over Ping Pong when I left, that was her good idea. And she had seen it on Broadway in New York. And because Ping Pong's mission was about cultural diplomacy and using the art to have difficult conversations and to show sides you don't see in mass media, she felt this play absolutely rang true with our vision, would help us achieve that mission of using the arts as a bridge. And so we started and we'd had many years of developing partnerships with universities and education institutions. So we decided that a play that's this brutal, you know, it's four people around a dinner table, Pakistani-American lawyer, his white wife, his African-American colleague at the law firm, and her Jewish husband, post 9/11, talking about Islamophobia, race, gender, it gets explosive, it's ugly. So something that potentially traumatic, we didn't think was responsible to bring out of context into China you know, see a performance. All right, everybody, goodbye. Have a good night. So we decided to bring it to education institutions instead that would allow us to do curricular materials, have conversations in the classroom first, get the students to read the play, and then do post-show talks after each show that would allow us to dive deeper into the issues. And it was quite funny, the story, things can move very quickly in China. And being a small institution, we were able to be very nimble. And I remember the first time I called the director, Timothy Douglas, from Beijing. I think I emailed him and we had a phone call. He tells the story of hanging up that phone call. And the first thought he had was, oh, that's never going to happen. That's a pipe dream. They're never going to tour that. That's crazy. I'm not going to China. And we were talking about doing it within the next 6 months, which is the other time span he didn't think was possible. And in the end, we did. And it was an incredibly successful tour and really quite transformative. And after I left Ping Pong and came to West Kowloon, Meng Tong brought the play back to for another round, another staging in Shanghai at the opening of another venue.
You've spoken in the past about being foreign. So what's your idea of home?
People are home. It's finding your family. And with Beijing, I was lucky to find it with the colleagues at Beijing Modern Dance Company, at Tao Dance Theater, with the different artists I work with, Gu Jiani, with my colleagues at Ping Pong. You build this family of people with a shared vision where you feel safe enough to have the bad ideas. I think that at West Kowloon, our goal is to create home for our audiences. I think being a venue, being a geographic location with the art park and all of this space, I think one of the things, certainly Hong Kong, given everything we've just experienced with the protests for 8 months and now the coronavirus, and then coming out of that, people need to feel safe again, need to feel like they can come together and have shared joy. And that's, I actually feel very strongly at West Kowloon. I'm in the job of homemaking right now. I'm in the job of creating that sense of home for our audiences, our artists, and first and foremost, our colleagues, the other producers on my team, so that they feel that sense of home here, a collective family where we can have the fights over the dinner table and then keep going. And I think that one of the reasons art can be so powerful is when you see something that echoes the familiar. The thing about home is you feel seen. You feel that you've been seen by someone. And when you're sitting in a dark theater or you're participating in a workshop or you're having some other theatrical experience and something resonates that feels familiar, even if it's totally quote unquote foreign, even if it's something completely out of the ordinary, you in that moment feel seen even though you're the watcher. And I think that's part of the power of that impact. It also builds greater empathy. I talk a lot about empathy. We try and talk about it here. Empathy is one of those skills that perhaps the future robots that might run our world won't have. And so how do we continue to maintain the relevance of humanness? And it's that needing to have empathy, especially in a more divisive world that is quite ugly and violent. And again, the role, the urgency of performing arts to build that empathy, you don't have to agree with someone or something or an artwork that you see. But if you understand what's behind it, it creates that empathy that breaks down that sense of quote unquote other.
Are your favorite projects the ones that are like impossible or the ones that come in and just sort of land in your lap and get made beautifully and you don't have to think about it?
Do the latter even exist? There's different flavors of hard. I think I'm trying to think of examples. There's hard. We had a project with University of Indiana at Bloomington that was really hard because the guy at the other end who was organizing it had no clue what he was doing. I think he was an English professor that was tasked with doing a China festival, and he was just totally out of his element. And every step of the way was hard. And in the end, the whole thing fell apart, and it was deeply dissatisfying. And I'd like to blame him that it was all his fault, but he was just put in a position he shouldn't have been put in. That kind of hard was not worth it and not satisfying and truly frustrating. On the other hand, working with a very difficult artist like Tao Ye from Tao Dance Theater, who, you know, is not easy and a lot of the projects were hard, getting visas for Chinese artists to go to Brazil and Singapore and all over the world is hard, but the result that comes out of it is so monumental that it's deeply satisfying. And you look back, you know, I mean, everyone uses the cheesy analogy of childbirth. You forget the pain because the result is so worth it. I think those are that's the kind of project that I like, that's juicy, that gets your creative juices flowing about problem solving.
And time frame, would you rather work on something for 3 years or 3 weeks?
I like variety. I'm one of those people that reads a lot of books at once. And I love the ones that you can whoosh through onto the next, but I also like the slow pace. And certainly in a big institution like West Kowloon, you need quick and long. You need to be planning the big, ambitious projects that aren't going to actually be given to your audience for 3 years, but you want something every day so that they feel that immediacy. And I think the long game, the short wins help keep your energy there. So I love being able to bring in artists to our live house every weekend to perform and to go online, you know, live broadcast. That can be immediate. I see something, let's do it this weekend, done. It feels so good to just get her done. On the other hand, to be able to build something that requires all of the little steps of fundraising and, okay, we want to do this massive festival in 3 years' time. How are we going to get there? When you get to that moment, that's such a huge win. And I actually was going to jump to something else, is I think one of the hard parts about being a producer is, as a performer, you get the catharsis of the applause at the end of the night. So there's almost like an arc and a completion to that circle. And with producers, it's really hard. You never get that. It's just one long, there's no, oh, we're done. I mean, yes, the project's done, but you're kind of building onto the next one. And there isn't that climactic moment. And I think energetically that can be really hard to sustain.
One of my things that inspired this podcast was thinking about how producers are the people who make things happen and they kind of drive the marketing. So why aren't they more famous?
Don't know. Why are they more famous? I think
you guys control it.
You know, it's interesting. I two thoughts to that. Why aren't they more famous? I think one thing I used to say, I have this producer's manifesto that's just little lines of what a producer is. And one of the earliest thoughts I had when I was working with different artists was, the artist is the what, the producer is the how. And maybe the how isn't as sexy. You know, you want to see the what. And then, like, I think it was one of the business gurus, Simon Sinek or somebody, says they actually buy your why. And so we might help articulate the why, and we're the how that makes it done, but they're going to see the what, the front man, the front woman, and that's the artist. And maybe what's so fabulous about this podcast is you're showing the heroism of the how. And it is, and as you said, it's the floor and the mop. It's the day-to-day blood, sweat, and tears, which artists do too, of course. But certainly the producer side of it, the filling in 10 hours of visa forms is not sexy. And yet without that, the artist would never leave their country.
Do you have any advice to your younger self?
Start doing. You learn by doing in our industry very much. Michael Kaiser, who runs the Kennedy Center, or no longer Kennedy Center, DeVos Arts Management Institute, he used to liken it to surgery. You don't become a good surgeon by reading books about it and going to school. You have to just get the knife out and start cutting. And I think with producing, there are certain principles you can learn about accounting, about certain, you know, strategic planning. But until you're out there doing and learning and stumbling, it doesn't work. So just start with one project. And another colleague once gave me is just start with one. You just need the first project. You don't need the career. You just need step one, one project.
Have you had mentors or guides that have helped you on that journey, or have you just done it all?
Oh gosh, of course. I have an army of guides that I would never have, I wouldn't be alive probably quite literally had it not been for people, so many names. For me, there was a journey of allowing myself to say, I don't know how to do something. And I think that's a classic, you know, young person is thinking you're supposed to know everything, and admitting that you don't know is a sign of weakness. It's not, it's the ultimate strength. If you don't admit you don't know it, you're going to just keep making the same mistakes and feel very alone. So once I started admitting first to myself and then to others that I didn't know, help finds you in a lot of ways. And certainly something as simple as going, I'm eternally grateful to ISPA. My first ISPA conference was 2006, ironically here in Hong Kong as a volunteer, and just to be surrounded by these people and start conversations and ask them what they did and how they did it and why, and mostly why, was quite exciting. But the how is the ugly, boring, nitty gritty. That's really the hardest part, but that's where it happens. And now on the flip side, what I find when people ask me for advice, and I'm sure you find this too, sometimes when people come to you for advice, it can be quite off-putting. And then other people, you just want to do everything you possibly can to help them. And for me, I think the difference is perhaps also that humility, but there are people who've come and say, oh, I want to be you, or I want to do what you do. And that's a little bit off-putting. And then instead, when they come and they say, this is what makes me passionate, and I have these questions, and I don't understand this, and I wonder if you can help, then I get excited, because it's about their vision and their dream, and not, it feels internal, not externally driven, I guess.
Everything goes to plan until you get punched in the face. Are there times when this has rung true in producing?
I'll start with more recent. So West Kowloon is this incredible project that has existed much earlier than I came around. But when I came here, I had my team, we had our excitement. They'd been doing all these projects that were leading up to the opening. And first we opened the Shichi Center, the Chinese Opera House, in January of 2019. And then in April, May, Free Space was supposed to open. And so we had our whole first year planned out, and we had all of these premieres, and we were bringing in groups like artists like Sakamoto, and we were going to program all these things. And then the building's delayed. And then the building's delayed again. And then the protests start. And suddenly the best laid plans of mice and men are delayed by building construction issues, are in the midst of giant social unrest, and then the coronavirus. And so all of these external things that not only disrupt your plans, but frankly disrupt the entire context and industry in which you thought you were operating. And all of these existing systems and skills and infrastructure are no longer the default. And so back to your earlier question about, do you like hard or easy things? I think the hardest thing that our entire industry is struggling with now is, what is the future of our industry? And what is our role as arts leaders, as producers, to produce the industry and the future that we're going to then have to live in? And it's a cliche, but building the bicycle while you ride it. We're rescheduling shows and trying to make things still go, but then that might not be valid in a few months.
Einstein said, the most beautiful thing we can experience is the mysterious. And I think that at the heart of anything that I do that's any good, there is a mystery or a secret. And it's the same as a relationship or an encounter. There has to be some kind of frisson based on the unknown. And yet your marketing team, your audience, very often the
government stakeholders,
everybody wants to know exactly what it is. So how do you navigate that?
I think you have to be polylingual. The way that you talk to your artists about exactly that ineffable, they've experienced it, so they understand what you mean. And they speak that same language. If I walk into LegCo, the Legislative Council here in Hong Kong, and I start talking in that language, they're going to look at me like I'm nuts and roll their eyes and think that we're completely wasting taxpayer money. So the language that you speak to government stakeholders, to foundations, to policymakers, and then even to your audience. Hong Kong has 7 million people. We have... The first 6 months of both Shichi Center and Free Space were almost entirely sold out. You'd think that was a win, but actually that's such a tiny fraction of audiences here in Hong Kong. How do we talk to the audiences who've never experienced the magic of sitting in a theater and just being crying because they don't know why? How do you use words to describe things that are indescribable, that you have to experience to understand? It's a real challenge, and the value that you bring, it's definitely a sales job, but the language, whether you're selling to a community in Yao Ji Mong district that's never walked into our theaters, even though they live spitting distance away, is going to be different than the language we use to the jockey club who might hopefully fund our next great community outreach project. And there's a learning curve to those languages. And it's getting everyone to sing from the same songbook, as it were, but in slightly different ways. I think our marketing team here at West Kowloon is really good at reaching our existing audience. I think we're still figuring out how to reach the audience that doesn't know how great we are yet.
I'm interested in the idea of scale and ambition. The business idea that scalable, bigger is better. But can't art sometimes be small and poignant?
Oof. It's interesting. In 16 years in mainland China, the mentality is definitely bigger is better. And so from an arts production side, I mean, if there was no scale, it was irrelevant. And one of the journeys was the growth of smaller theaters and smaller art spaces, and the idea that bigger didn't necessarily mean better quality. Frankly, it often means worse. At West Kowloon, which is very much about scale, we have a lot of conversations actually with our museums, because the museums, there's not necessarily the same capacity issue. A theater has a set number of seats. You can only have that number of butts in that number of seats and that number of performances on those set limited number of nights. So there is a reality of the limit of scalability. And I think the kind of the beauty and the tragedy of live performance is that it only happens in that one place at that one time, and then it's gone. It's the ultimate reflection of our mortality. It will be gone and die and not ever happen again. And that is a hard sell. If scalability sells, you know, making a video and selling it multiple times so that you have an object that is repeatable is potentially a better business model. On the other hand, it's funny, I was just listening to a Simon Sinek podcast, and he was talking about, I don't remember the exact term, but basically the idea of the lack of scalability is what creates the value. And that also makes sense. He said, you know, the reason people go to see the Mona Lisa and take that selfie isn't because they want the selfie, it's because they are in that scarce resource, that it can only be there.
Idea of the aura of the original. My last visit to China, I went to Hangzhou and went to the Song Dynasty, Legend of Song, saw 9 shows a day of 3,000 seat theater, the same show. And there's a thing that, as you sit down, it tells you that you're the 4 millionth before 26 million people had seen this show. And the overflow theater they built was 5,000 seats. And then they took me to the small experimental black box, which was 800 seats under construction. And I thought, I have no idea what any of those kind of figures mean. It was 15,600th show I saw at 3,000 people a show, and they're all full. And I thought, that experience versus the moment where you stare into someone's eyes. But who's to say you don't have those profound experiences even at scale?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I like to say it's and not or. You know, that's my sort of life motto, yeah. And not yeah, or. And certainly in a place like West Kowloon, I was just talking this morning, it's you can't be everything to everybody. You have to be different things to different people and get the right message to the right people. So we are going to build things of scale. We have an outdoor space that can have up to 10,000, 15,000 people. Our inaugural jazz fest last year had 14,000 people in 2 days with minimal advertising because of the protests. That was a huge success. And we had these incredible intimate spaces, 100, fewer than 100, where we can do experimental Chinese opera festival is something that we're now entering our third year this fall. And the number of people who want to see experimental Chinese opera might not be yet 15,000, but the impact and the value to that is still, you know, we need to have the language to articulate that value, because ultimately it's about diversity. If there's an ecosystem, the rule to, you know, diversify your portfolio, if we're talking financial terms.
Alison, that's been fantastic. I guess the question for you is there anything that you would like to else to say or to put out in the world? You can monologue, riff, scat, beatbox. I don't choose. You can mime, but it's a little obscure in the medium. I can audio describe your mime. So
that'll be our next performance concept. We'll work on that. That's a good idea.
It'll be beautiful.
Totally. Yeah. I guess going back to the difference between being a producer on the artist side versus being a producer and an artistic director on the venue side, the thing that links it, I think, is the role of storyteller and context. I think one of my jobs when I was working with artists in China, touring them out or bringing international work into China, was trying to work out every difference in context makes a difference. Now that I'm at West Kowloon, our different contexts, and I'm using air quotes around the word context, it is our different venues. So if we put something in our experimental Chinese opera festival, we're making a statement about Chinese opera and it's modernizing. And so that's very much in the frame of the Chinese Opera House of the Shichu Center. If we take that exact same production and put it in our dance festival that might have some martial arts inspired things, then we're saying something very different about that work of art. The work of art hasn't changed. We're just putting it in a different frame, in a different context, maybe in a different building. And as a producer in that, from this side, from the venue presenting side, you know, often you don't think of this side as producing. I think our role is very much about, it's the same. It's about storytelling by how you contextualize the art that we're putting in our buildings and in our different curatorial frameworks.
Alison, it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for sharing your insights and stories. I'm Yaron Lifshitz, and you've been listening to Producing Heroes, a Circa podcast, produced by Lauren Isinger. If you've been listening on Apple Podcasts, please consider writing a review. And if you like what you've heard, you can find us on social media at Circa Contemporary Circus, #ProducingHeroes.